All right. Hey, good morning, everyone. My name is Keith, and I'm an alcoholic. I will do my very level best to keep profanity at a minimum, but that's about as much as I can promise. I'll jump right into my story. It's not unlike most of the people in this room. I think that's why I'm so attracted to AA, the fellowship. I mean, I got sober at a place called YANA, which stands for You Are Not Alone. And that was exactly what I needed, to not be alone. I needed to be surrounded by other people who understood what I was going through. So I guess you would begin. My mother and father met one another in college. My mother went to school on an academic scholarship. My father went to school on an athletic scholarship. And my mother and father dated for a very short period of time, and my mother got pregnant. And my dad's father was a Baptist minister, and my mother grew up in the church, and that was a time when you did what was right. So they got married. And my dad was a wild guy himself in college. He had been kicked out of school for partying too much, for failing out of school, and he ended up going back. But my dad was one of the first players at his college to be drafted into the pros. So my father played for the San Francisco 49ers and the St. Louis Cardinals. So they got married. I happened to be born in Dayton, Ohio, but we eventually settled when my dad's playing career was over in Lathonia, Georgia, because it's where my father grew up, and he wanted me and my brother eventually to be close to his siblings. My dad had 9 brothers and a sister, and he wanted me to grow up with my cousins and all of his family, and he thought that that was really important. My brother came along about 5 years later. I hated my brother's guts. As far as I was concerned, he ruined Christmas, man. All of a sudden, he came along and my shit got cut in half. And I just did not care for him for that very reason. But now we're extremely close. My senior year in college was my brother's freshman year, and he went to school at the same school. And I got to look out for him. And he played football his first year there, and he was my backup. So when my parents would come to games, I would actually fake getting hurt so he got to play and my parents could get a chance to see him play. And he is one of the best guys that you would ever want to know. And I love him to death. But because my parents came from a religious background, I grew up in church. I mean, I'm not unfamiliar to the concept of church. I'm not unfamiliar to a power greater than myself. I just lost track of it. And, you know, the God that I knew, man, he was designed to punish. He was not designed to give grace or to show love. So I struggle with church. But my folks were very, very active. My mother and father are not really drinkers at all. I mean, I've never seen my dad drunk. I've never seen my mother drunk. I've seen my dad drink. And my dad has drank with me. But I never saw them inebriated. I never saw them out of sorts or wild or crazy or anything like that. But I clearly remember at 5 years old, my dad with his friends and me asking, could I taste his beer? And reluctantly, he said, yeah, sure. And I remember tasting it, and all of a sudden, this amazing calm came over me. At 5 years old, it was just like, whew. But I was smart enough to know not to say how much I enjoyed it. I think that was my first real experience with lying. That I was just like, that's disgusting, that's gross. But I was like, oh, shit, I want some more of that. That made me, put me at ease. It took me out of whatever was going on in my head. Fast forward to, you know, school, elementary school, high school. I did really well in school without having to pay attention. I mean, I'm an auditory learner. I don't have to really read, although I enjoy reading, but if I listen intently, I can pick up. So I was not a, you know, I was a good enough student to get by, and it came easy, and I didn't have to really study. I didn't have to really try, and I was immersed in sports. I played football, basketball, baseball. I ran track. Well, I say I participated in track. I hate running, so I was a high jumper. Cause I didn't have to run, but Sports came real easily. I mean, I was fortunate. I inherited my father's athleticism, and it just, I didn't have to lift weights. I jumped higher than anybody. I ran faster than anybody. I could do it for longer than most people, and it was easy. I didn't have to work at it. By about the 10th grade, drugs and alcohol started seeping into my life. By 10th grade, I had my first blackout drinking at a party. And you know, I remember going home, my buddy leaving me in the front yard, dropping me off. And I was passed out in the front yard. My dad came and got me, put me in the bed. I fell out of bed like three times that night, you know. And that was my first experience with drinking. And then my ride to school, when I was in like the 11th and 12th grade, the guy who gave me my ride to school, his brother was a local drug dealer. So we used to wake and bake every day on the way to school. And then I experimented with, you know, LSD. We used to do mushrooms. We used to do different things. Drugs are not a huge part of my story. When I decided to end them, I ended them. But they are a part of my overall story. Sports in high school created for me a great sense of entitlement. Because I was good, I got away with a lot of shit. Because they needed me for the big game. Or they needed me to, you know, play. I mean, I was, you could never pin anything on me, but I was always a usual suspect. I was always there. I was in the mix. But, you know, you could never really pin anything on me. And as far as relationships, like with girls or those things, man, I was cool with you until you had a problem with the shit that I did or you got in the way of me having a good time. And then I'd move on to the next girl. I'd find one that didn't mind as much, that I, you know, didn't pay her as much attention, or I came around when I wanted to come around, or, you know, but it was not as important to me as sports were and as partying were. Athletically, I mean, I did so well that I was fortunate enough I got a scholarship to go to college, just like my dad. And I ended up going to Clemson University. And what they don't tell you is, you know, you always hear these kids who get full rides to school. Well, a full ride, it's not a four-year ride. It's a one-year renewable scholarship. And it's based on performance. And if you don't perform, guess what? The next year, it doesn't get renewed. And I lost sight of that. I forgot they brought me to school to play football. I thought they brought me to school to have a good time. And I partied my way right out of a scholarship. It was very interesting. The kind of description I gave you guys was the same description Coach Danny Ford gave me when he kicked me out of school. He said, son, we can't pin anything on you, but you're always around trouble when it pops off and it happens. And you're always one of the usual suspects. And he was exactly, you know, right. My first year I redshirted, my second year I played and I did extremely well. That spring I tore my ACL and it took me a year and a half to recover because I didn't take rehab seriously. I partied my way through rehab and I was not the same player I was when I came back. Therefore I lost my scholarship and everybody on campus knew me, but they all knew me for the wrong reason. And it was because if you saw my name in the paper, it wasn't for making a tackle. It was because I had done some shit that got me in the paper. And you know, you read about guys, and I'm sure you've read about guys who get kicked out of school, and you're like, man, what a waste. What a knucklehead. Why would somebody throw that opportunity away? Well, you were probably talking about me. Chances are pretty doggone good that you were referring to me. Well, I got lucky when Clemson kicked me out of school. They realized I had an issue, whether I realized it or not. Even then, drinking was becoming a problem. So they sent me, they gave me another scholarship opportunity to another school. I ended up going to Carson Newman, which is in Johnson City, Tennessee, I believe. And I got there and I remember my dad dropped me off. I unpacked my bags. I end up meeting two guys who were friends with a guy I played with at Clemson. And we started putting two and two together, and it ended up this whole new crop of players they had brought in. We were all the misfit toys. You know that island in the old story? We were all these misfits who had been kicked out of other schools, and we all ended up at this school. You know, Randy, I remember he was starting quarterback at Missouri. He had been kicked out. He ended up there. Jeffrey, he was starting linebacker at Mississippi State. He got kicked out and he was there. And I met them on day one. And it's true what they say, like attracts like. I mean, man, we found each other like boom, like that. And I remember we all unpacked and we were like, man, let's go find somewhere to buy some beer. And that's when I realized that the school was in a dry county. So they had sent me to a school specifically that they knew I couldn't drink in. And I'm like, holy shit, you know, what are we going to do? And by the end of week one, we had met the local drug dealer on campus. And I'll never forget, he was a guy, he was in a wheelchair and he sold weed and we went over to his house and it was the worst weed I'd ever smoked in my life. I was like, man, this is god awful. I can't drink. I can't smoke weed. That same day I found out that it was a requirement at the school that you had to go to church for 1 hour every day. And I'm like, man, fuck this shit. I'm out. So by week two, I'm back at home. I show up at home and my dad is like, what are you doing here? And I'm like, look, dad, it didn't work out. And, you know, he's like, well, I tell you what, if you're going to be at home, you're going to work and you're going to go to school and you're going to pay for it. I've been the beneficiary of not ever having to pay for your school and I'm not going to start now. So I worked for a sprinkler company installing underground sprinkler systems, which is a fancy name for digging ditches. And that's what I did. I dug ditches. I had enough film on me from Clemson that I was able to send it around to some schools. And lo and behold, I got a scholarship to Kentucky State University in Frankfort, Kentucky. And they offered me a full ride. I had to sit out a year before I could play. But Kentucky State was like utopia for me. My dad gave me a hard time about it. I mean, I went from Clemson where you played in front of 80,000 fans to Kentucky State where you were lucky if you played in front of 6,000. And my dad used to say, son, you went from the big house to the outhouse. I'm like, yeah, that was a pretty good description of it. But I flourished, man. My first year there, I made all conference as a outside linebacker. My next year there, my senior year, I was made team captain and I made all conference as a tight end. And I played really well, got a lot of recognition. I met my first wife while I was there and we became inseparable. And as I look back, it was because she was one of the first people that just accepted me for me. Good, bad, or indifferent. All my faults, man, she let me do whatever I wanted to do. And that was exactly the kind of, I mean, I could hang out with my buddies. I could maybe make it home, maybe not. I could, you know, be up on campus all day. I could, you know, I could just be me, who I wanted to be. And she was cool with that. Well, after football was over, I tried out for a couple of different teams. I was told the same thing at every stop. Man, number one, you're not big enough. Number two, you're too slow. So I got lucky, and the Seattle Seahawks invited me out to camp. And, oh, I got to tell this story. So my thing of entitlement is a continual story. I mean, I got away with stuff that people just should not be allowed to get away with. Kentucky State, my senior year, for a homecoming, my best friend, who was co-captain of the football team, he and I got drunk and we did donuts on the president's lawn and tore it up before the homecoming game, and they called us. Of course, they knew. I mean, a small campus. They knew it was us. But they couldn't kick us out of school. They couldn't kick us off the team because they needed us for the homecoming game. And so I got away with it, you know. My senior year, we won the region championship my senior year in high school. And almost everybody knew I had took a hit of acid before the game. And it was the best game I ever played. It was how I ended up getting my scholarship. Clemson said, hey, they looked at the film. It was the most intense they ever watched anybody play. So I had this kind of history of just getting away with shit all the damn time. So, and that goes hand in hand in Seattle. Me and a bunch of players, we went out after kind of drills and practice. And the guy who was driving got so drunk he passed out at the red light. And we drifted across traffic and ended on the medium at about 3 a.m. in the morning. Cops showed up, found out we played for Seattle, and they called his cab, sent us home, and let us go. So this resounding theme of, man, I always got away with shit. And I was above the rules was like a just a regular theme and a regular story. So let me kind of move on. So my girlfriend at the time, who ultimately ended up being my first wife, when we graduated from college, we moved back to Lithonia. I did the same thing as my dad. Me and my dad are like this, and we are so much alike, it's incredible. Our lives are very, very parallel. You know, he got in trouble in school, I got in trouble in school. He got married early, I got married early. I mean, they really run neck and neck. But my first wife and I, we moved back home, and right away we went to work. I mean, work was very important for us. My first wife actually got her master's in college waiting on me to graduate. It took me so long to graduate, she got a master's degree. I was on the six-year program in college, because between redshirting, medical redshirting, took me 6 years to get my degree. But she got her master's waiting on me to get done, and we went off to work, and we were highly competitive. My first wife was a volleyball player, and she played professional beach volleyball, and she was a beast on the volleyball court, and she was extremely competitive, and I always ended up with better jobs than her. I mean, when we started working, immediately she got promoted, I get promoted. Then I get promoted again, and then she get promoted. Well, then I get promoted again. And she was getting promoted based on performance. I was getting promoted based on who I knew and who I partied with. I just had a way of getting in good with people. And next thing you know, they like me. And, hey, man, by the way, I got this job over here. I think you'd be great at, sure. And it just worked that way. But it created a lot of animosity in our relationship, because she was like, here I am. I went to school. I worked hard. And here you are just being you. And you're getting better jobs than I get. You're making more money than I make. And, you know, as I look back on it, yeah, it was a little unfair. And it was always a bone of contention in our relationship. In 1995, well, let me say this. We excelled and did really well. We got the really nice home fast. We got the cars fast. We probably had one of the best work deals anybody could imagine. My wife worked for Delta. She was a human resources director for all of the flight attendants. And I worked for Avis Rent-A-Car. I was regional director of operations. So we could fly anywhere. We could pick up a car. And then her brother worked for Embassy Suites. So wherever we went, we got a place. And I mean, we just traveled all over the country, all over the world, as a matter of fact. And we had the best of both worlds. And then in 1995, my son came along, and everything changed after that. My son, my dad used to take me everywhere with him when I was a little kid. And I did the same with my son. He rolled with me everywhere. If I went to the grocery store, he was with me. If I went fishing, I took him with me. If I went to work and we didn't have arrangements, he went with me. I mean, I took that kid everywhere. And over time, my drinking, which had, it had kind of been under wraps, but it started escalating. My wife suffered greatly after the birth of my son from depression. And she went through it for about 3 years. And of course, I didn't understand what was going on. I just knew she didn't want shit to do with me. And me being the selfish man, how dare you don't want shit to do with me? And my son became the center of my universe. He became the center of her universe, and we lost sight of one another. And our relationship was pretty non-existent, and it turned out we were both okay with that. And we just kind of muddled through it. But my drinking started to escalate, and I had this pattern of, you know how some people drink and they get like crazy happy and touchy-feely, and they're laughing, and they're, you know, life of the party. And then some people just mean as shit, and you don't want to be around them at all. Well, I was somewhere in between. My ex-wife used to describe it as I would go gray. It wasn't black and white. You couldn't make sense of anything to me. I was in a gray zone where you messed around and you said the wrong thing. You didn't know what you were going to get. Not one way, shape, or form. And nobody liked being around me when I went gray. And I was going gray more and more often. So it's around this time that wheels on the bus start falling off. I mean, I'm drinking more often. I'm lying all the time because I have to lie about where I am, what I'm doing, what I'm up to. I'm running through money like crazy. I mean, and not like spending it on drugs or anything. I told you drugs are a part of my early story. But once I got into the working world, the kind of jobs I had or I wanted, I always had to be drug tested. So, because I handled money and I dealt with, you know, assets and I had the ability to write checks. So I just stopped getting high. I just went, okay, I can't get high anymore. I'm fine with that. So guess what? I can't get high anymore. How do I offset that? Well, my drinking went up and it got worse. But at this time, I'm going through money because I love nice things. And I felt nothing was out of my reach. If I wanted it bad enough, I deserved it, and I would buy it. So money is becoming an issue. Lying is becoming an issue. I can't keep up with the lies that I'm telling. And it's becoming an issue. And all of a sudden, I'm being busted for everything under the sun. And I got myself in trouble at work over money, and we had to leave. Georgia. We were living in Metro Atlanta at the time. And I mean, we had to leave fast because what I did was so jacked up that, all right, man, they find this out, I'm in trouble. So we ended up moving to Jacksonville, Florida. I convinced the people I was working with at the time that, hey, there's this area, territory in Jacksonville I'd be perfect for. So they relocated me. And so I escaped that again, not held accountable to the consequences of my action. I got away with it totally, completely. Nobody ever found out about it. Nobody knew about it but me and my wife. Totally scot-free. I got away with it. So I'm in Jacksonville making a geographic move to get away from trouble. My drinking escalates. I get in trouble in Jacksonville. We have to make a geographic move to Noonan, Georgia. Totally escape it. Get away from it. My drinking escalates. Get in trouble in Newman. Have to move and relocate. We go to Peachtree City, not that far away. My drinking escalates. It's just this continual pattern. By this time, I think I had worn my ex-wife out. She had had enough. I mean, and I don't blame her. So we separated, and we were separated for about a year. She moved to Tampa. I was still in Metro Atlanta. My parents had been involved in a serious accident. They were in a head-on collision. And I sold my house, moved in with them to help them go through rehab and recover and all of the above. I'm dating somebody new while I'm still married. I'm seeing somebody else. And all of a sudden, you know, my ex-wife, who we hadn't been together in a year, I see my son every other weekend. I could fly and see him. I could drive and see him. She could fly him up because she still worked for Delta at the time. So I'm maintaining that relationship, but it's not what it used to be. You know, I used to coach him in basketball, football, baseball. I was always there. Well, now I'm a every other weekend dad, and I'm not enjoying that. So I'm drinking over that as well. She came to me, I'll never forget, in Lithonia to my parents' house where they still live. And she said, well, I want to work things out. You know, I want to try and give this another chance and I want to see if we can figure this out and work it out. And I'm like, yeah, sure. So the young lady I'm dating, I have to tell her, okay, we can't see each other anymore. I'm going back to my wife. I go back. I'm there for 2 months. And, they tell me I got to get out. You got to move out. And lo and behold, then it hits me that I've been completely, the okey-doke has been pulled on Keith. They brought me back to Florida so the courts could hold me accountable in Florida. They couldn't hold me accountable in Georgia because they had no idea what I made and they couldn't make sense of my income. But once I got back into Florida and they could pin me down with an address and a workplace and all of that, well, then she hit me with divorce. So I ended up, you know, alimony, child support. At the end, I just handed everything over. I handed over the house. I handed over the furniture. I handed over the car. All I took was my vehicle and the clothes on my back. So I went about a 2-month period of time with no job at that time. Cause I turned around and quit the job so they couldn't nail me down for child support. That was my solution. You know, I had money in the bank, which she didn't know where the money was in the bank. So I'll make it work until I figure it out. So, I was homeless for about 2 months trying to figure it out, trying to get my hands on my money, which, you know, was tied up in stock and tied up in some other things that it wasn't immediately accessible to me. But, for 2 months I lived in my car, my Lexus, behind the, LA Fitness. And I maintained my gym membership because at least every day I could shower. I could brush my teeth. I could shower. I could clean up. I knew the guy at the LA Fitness who was the GM, because I partied with him. He allowed me to maintain a locker and keep one without cutting it off on a regular basis so I could keep most of my clothes in. The other clothes were in the trunk of my car. And at the same time, I decided I'm trying to figure out what to do. I don't really know where this thing is going to go, but I always land on my feet, so I'll figure it out. And I decide I'm going to get an insurance license. So I apply for an insurance license, life, health, variable annuities. And again, I'm an auditory learner. So they have this class where you can, they'll basically tell you 70% of the answers on the test. And the other 30 kind of rotate, or you have to study to learn the remainder of them. So I go to this class and, you know, the guy, very thorough, good guy. And I still talk to him to this day. His name's, they call him Big Dog. Great guy. At the end of it, I study for about 2 weeks on my own, or I at least try to, cause I just, man, my head was so jacked up. I couldn't stop drinking on a daily basis. I basically turned into a bar fly. I mean, I could walk into the bar. I had my own seat. They knew what I drank, and I was there almost every day. But finally, I go and take the test. You have to make a 70 to get your license at least. I scored a 70.5 on the test. So again, no problem, man. I just slide on through. Skate and make it like it was nothing. I get my insurance license, and I had about a 2-year run, guys, where I was not the most knowledgeable sales guy, but I knew enough that I could bullshit people and sell. And man, I sold like crazy. I'm talking about, you know, I just hit the ground running. Next thing you know, the next year, I've made so much money, I can afford an office now. I get an office. Next thing you know, all right, now I got 2 employees. I got a young lady who answers my phones and schedules all of my appointments, and I got a young lady who speaks Spanish who works for me on the weekend, and I run Spanish-speaking appointments. And, I mean, I am killing it. And lo and behold, that was 2007. That next year was 2008. And for those of you who remember 2008, that was when the market just kind of tanked. And people started opting to buy food, pay their car payments, pay their mortgage, as opposed to having health insurance. And all of a sudden, people started canceling my policies, which was residual income, you know, and man, I lost it all. Lost everything. So now I'm back broke again, or near broke. The one thing while I was in the insurance class, I met a young lady while I was studying to get my insurance exam, and we immediately hit it off. Man, she was funny. She was from France. She was funny, had the accent. Man, she was cute. And, man, she drank like I drank. And that was the worst relationship I could have ever gotten into, because she didn't bat an eye at the fact that I drank a fifth of vodka a day, because she drank 2 bottles of wine a day. And we could, man, we partied, we had something at our house every weekend, and we both, she had an insurance business, I had an insurance business, we lived in a boating community, we lived on the water, all of our neighbors would come over to our house on the weekend and hang out and party, we would cook out, we would drink, all of our kids were friends with each other, and it sounds awesome, but man, it was horrible. I mean, my drinking escalated to the point where I remember going to a conference for insurance business. And I got so drunk at the conference that, you know, I passed out. In the middle of the night, I woke up to go to the bathroom. And I'm sitting there and I'm peeing. And I look around and I'm in the lobby. And I'm peeing up against a glass wall. And I'm naked. I mean, butt-ass naked. And on top of that, I can't remember what room I just walked out of. Because I look back behind me and there's four doors. And I'm not going to start knocking on them. So I walk down the hall, you know, no clothes on. Luckily, there's a cart there. So I grab a sheet and everything, and I wrap it around me, and I go to the front desk. And they ended up, because I couldn't recall, you know, the room and everything, they were finally able to get me into it. But, you know, that was a sure sign the wheels were falling off the bus. I had flown to Atlanta for a meeting with a buddy of mine, and I woke up in the bathroom of the plane, up against the wall, like sitting on the toilet, pressed up against the wall, face like this, and I wake up. And I'm like, holy shit. So I get up, I put on my clothes, because I'm drinking Jack and Coke, it's 6 a.m. flight, and I'm flying first class, and I start hitting them first thing in the morning. So by the time I wake up, I pull up my pants, I put on my clothes, I go back and sit in the same seat I had gotten out of. Plane lands, I walk in the airport, and I'm like, man, this isn't Atlanta Airport. I was in Charlotte, North Carolina. They had forgot to check the bathroom when we went to Atlanta, and we hit the next flight to Charlotte. That was another pretty good sign that shit is like getting real. And the wheels are falling off of the bus. I told you before, I used to go gray. I was going gray a whole lot more. And it got to the point where we had an argument one night, she and I got violent. Apparently. At least I'm told I got violent. And the next morning I wake up and I know something's not right. And I'm kind of tiptoeing around it because I'm waiting to see how the dust settles. And our doorbell rings, and it's her three brothers standing at the door. And they're telling me I got to go. And I'm a little hungover. I got enough alcohol in my system that although it's three of them, I'm like, I want to see you make me fucking go. And they were a little bit older, and I guess they decided, well, hey, we need you to go. Can you please leave? And I'm like, no, I don't think that's going to happen. So, you know, they end up calling the cops. And the cops, I tell them, look, I need time to pack my shit. Nah, you know, we agree she'll give me 3 days to pack my stuff together. During that 3 days leading up to it, I mean, I'm hitting it hard. And I remember passing out on the sofa one night. The next morning, I wake up and my cell phone rings and it's somebody from the AA hotline. And they're like, hey, you know, Mr. Johnson, we're just calling to see if you're okay. And I'm like, who the fuck is this? And they're like, well, you called us last night around 3 o'clock. You said you saw one of our commercials. It was like 3 a.m. those commercials about if you have a drinking problem, you ought to call. I must have called. And they're like, well, and I'm saying, ma'am, did my ex-wife put you up to this shit? Did my, you know, girlfriend put you up to this shit? And they're like, no, no, you called us and you asked for help. Bullshit, you're lying. And, you know, man, I'm just going off. And, you know, that's just more examples of how the the wheels were falling off. I was spiraling. So I end up getting kicked out, and I find a one-bedroom townhouse. And when I say one-bedroom townhouse, it was really a three-bedroom townhouse. I had enough money to rent one room. Now, at the same time, my ex-wife has kicked my son out of the house, and he has nowhere to stay. So he comes to live with me. So for about, I think it was about 3 months, my son and I are sharing a bed, staying in one room, sharing a bathroom, because we had the one room where there was a master, and I'm taking him to school every day. And we're back like this again. Except we're really not, because my son is a pothead and gets high every day on a regular basis, or he used to. He's gotten better now, and he's really actually turned it around. He's going pretty good. But we're just, man, barely scraping by. We're just barely navigating life. And at this time, I'm working for Bally's Total Fitness. I don't know if you guys know about Bally's Total Fitness. I could make career changes at a whim, you know. So, you know, I'm working out twice every day trying to figure out what my next move is. Somebody approaches me and says, man, I watch you work out. You ought to be a trainer. I'm like, okay, I'll give it a try. So I go into Bally's, say, look, I can sell like crazy. I don't know the personal training business, but if you give me a chance, I guarantee you I can catch on. They give me a chance next thing you know, I'm training. I got more clients than anybody in the gym. I'm a horrible trainer. I'm terrible. I know how to train myself. I know how to work out, but man, I don't know how to teach other people to work out. So I go get certified. I go get some licenses. I get better, but I've got about 35 clients that I'm training 2 days a week, 70 hours a week, and I'm killing it. I'm very good. I learned all the supplements in the place and how they work. So now I'm selling supplements on top of it. I'm making commission off of that. I'm doing really well. And then they found out that I had management experience. So they made me the assistant personal training director. And then the girl who was the personal training director quit. They made me the personal training director. The guy who was the general manager quit. They made me the GM. Next thing you know, things are rolling again. Repercussions in my actions, it just worked itself out again, as it always does. I mean, I stay down, but I don't stay down long. It just always works itself out. Around this time, I meet this gorgeous woman at the gym, and I watching her work out, and I mean, she is a beast. She is killing it. Beautiful woman, but worked out hard, you know, not the prim and proper, worried about sweating, wearing matching outfits, all of that shit. No, she just came to the gym and she worked out. So I approached her and I was like, hey, you ever thought about being a trainer? Well, no, I got a full-time job. Well, you really ought to consider it. You're a little bit, you know, you're my age. I have a certain niche of clients and yada, yada, yada. No, no thanks. So I have a birthday party at a club in Tampa called a Blue Martini. And I invite, man, I probably got like 150 people show up to my birthday party. And I invited her. She said, well, you know, I've got my high school reunion. I don't know if I can come, but I'll try. Well, it turns out she makes it. That was 13 years ago, and we've been together ever since that night. And she's my wife, absolute love of my life. Funny story is, you know, I'm trying to hire her as a trainer for $18 an hour. And after we started dating, I go to her house and I'm looking around. I'm like, man, this is a fucking nice ass house. What do you do for a living? And she's like, well, I work in, you know, workers' comp. I said, well, that's what you do. But what do you do for the company? She's like, oh, well, I'm the CEO. Again, strike gold. Things work themselves out. I'm back on top again. Life's pretty good. I'm drinking like an absolute fish now. Probably down in damn near a fifth and a half a day. But I'm so incredibly good at hiding it. I mean, I'm amazing at hiding it. My wife and I, after we met, 2 months later, she moved me and my son in with her. We've never been apart since then. Me, her, and my son have been apart because probably after 8 months, he had to go because he was just like his old man. Maybe a little bit worse, But you know, I had to make the decision. Do I want to hold on to this relationship, or we got to make some different arrangements? So we made some different arrangements. But we were together for 2 years before my wife even found out I drank. Because we went out. I never ordered drinks. I never brought alcohol into the house. I drank in my car. I drank on the way to work. I drank on the way back. I had my alcohol stashed outside in a shed. She never knew I drank. It was in my golf bag. It was in my wheel well. It was in my gym bag. And it wasn't until one day I took her car for whatever reason and forgot a bottle under the seat. And when she hit the brakes, it rolled forward. That's when, why would you have a bottle? Oh, you know, I made up some insane stories. Okay, well, I think it happened again. Or she one time, one night, went to drink my water to take a pill, and it was full of vodka. You know, just the signs started showing, and things really started escalating. And it didn't take much longer after that for her to figure out, wait a minute, you've been lying to me this whole time. And hiding your drinking. And she was spot on. I had been. So I came home one day. And all of my shit was packed. In the living room. And she said, Keith, I'm giving you two choices. You can change or you can change. And I'm like, what are you talking about? She said, you can either change what you're doing, change who you are, change how you are, or you can change addresses. Choice is yours. Man, this is... I'm so fortunate to have the relationship that I wanted. I was willing to say, look, I'll fix this. If it means I got to go to AA, I'll go to AA. I had an uncle who was in AA. He died 27 years sober. Can't be that bad because I remember he was a fucking mess. And he turned his life around. Amazing guy. I'm like, okay, can't be that. If Uncle Thomas can do it, I can do it. I couldn't do it. I just couldn't. I would have... a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks of some semblance of, and it wasn't even sobriety. I was just white knuckling it, man. You know, I don't want to drink. You know, I'm battling making that right turn into the liquor store all the time. I go ahead and I get a sponsor. I go through the steps. I get to step four and I have to do my character defects. That just blew my mind. I'm like, screw this. This is too hard. I get another sponsor. Going through the steps, we get to step four. About that time, he relapses. All I needed was an excuse to go back drinking. When he relapsed, that was all I needed. I'm like, look, man, this program is a bunch of bullshit. You can't even follow it. And you're trying to get me to follow it? And I went back out again. Started drinking again. Finally, my wife said, hey, look, Keith, you got to go back. Go get another sponsor. I go get another sponsor. I'm lying to that sponsor that I'm going to meetings, that I'm reading books. I'm not calling him regularly. I'm telling my wife that I am. Finally, he and my wife get together. And he totally spills the beans. And he tells my wife the words that probably changed my life and saved my life. He told her, look, if you don't get Keith help, he's going to die. He's going to die. You have two choices. You can leave him so you won't feel so bad when he dies. Or you can get him help and try and help him turn his life around. So at that point in time, my wife and I made the decision that I needed to go to rehab. Because I couldn't do it on my own. I tried on my own. I needed to dry out. I needed somewhere to just be away from everybody. So, of course, I go into rehab and, you know, they ask you, you know, have you detoxed? Yeah, sure, I detoxed. And I drank the night before I checked in to rehab. So I get in there and I'm on the third day and my body just goes nuts. And while I'm in rehab, I have this crazy-ass dream. Where, to sum it up, in the dream, I'm fighting myself. And it's just this big dark figure and I can't really see, but it's kicking my ass and it's winning. And I finally get a chance to get off a punch at it and I turn and it looks and the face is mine. I'm fighting me. To this day, I'm not a dream interpreter. I don't know if it was the bad me trying to beat the good me, or if it was the good me trying to stamp out the bad me. I don't know which one. It was almost like one of those God and devil type fights. All I'm happy to say is that obviously the good me won and the bad me lost, or else I wouldn't be standing here in front of you today. But that was kind of my spiritual awakening, and it happened there while I was in rehab. Greatest thing ever happened to me. While I was in rehab, I discovered the root cause of my drinking, and it goes all the way back to when I was in college. The root cause of my drinking is truly over regret. It was over regret that I didn't apply myself hard enough into sports and athletics, that I could have been all I think I could have been, because I was a pretty doggone good athlete. It was regret over my marriage dissolving and me throwing that away. It was the regret over business deals where I fucked people over and ran away from it and got away from it. It was regret over the disappointment I caused my mother and father of the guy that I had turned out to be. It was regret that I pissed and shitted on the Johnson name and made my grandfather not proud of who I was. After our family had an amazing reputation and a great amount of pride. It was all regret. Regret was what drove me to drink. The greatest word I learned while I was in rehab was incomprehensible demoralization. When I heard that word, it put its finger on what my problem was. It put its finger on how I felt in my heart and what I was dealing with. I couldn't have found a better word to have described it. So when I got out of rehab, man, things turned around immediately. I mean, like immediately, like they always do. Next thing you know, this job I have at the time I'm working for Lowe's, I took a leave of absence to go into rehab. When I came back about 2 months in, my boss was like, Keith, what is going on? You are extremely productive. You're not the same guy who left. What happened? And, you know, of course, I can't say, well, I got sober. I'm not drinking at work every day anymore, number one. and, you know, hey, I'm sober now. But next thing you know, they're asking me to do special projects. They're asking me about relocating, about being promoted again. I get promoted while I'm there. My wife, it took some time once I got sober for her to be fully convinced that I was. I'll never forget, it was about a year and a half into my sobriety, I was at Publix. I told my wife, I left the gym. I said, look, I'm swinging by Publix. Do you need anything? And she's like, yeah, sure. Pick me up this and this. And I'm like, all right. And maybe about 5 minutes later, she said, look, are you still at Publix? I said, yeah, I am. She said, I need you to go outside and go take a picture of Publix and send it to me. Because I always lied about where I was. I always lied about what I was doing. I always lied about what I was up to. And although our things were going well, she had not forgotten. You know, my son, he was cautiously optimistic that things would work out. Because I've realized now that I've been sober and I got some time under my belt, he missed his dad. And I missed him. So he kind of took a wait and see attitude about things, but work is thriving. My wife finally retires from her job, gets into acting. It's always been her passion. That's what she wanted to do. She does movies, commercials, and TV series. And she's got a pretty decent little career going. I mean, especially in the latter part of her life, but she auditioned for a role and they told her, look, if you're really serious about acting, you need to be in Metro Atlanta. So we decided to pick up and move. And it was the first time, although my career at Lowe's was going really well, that I did something for somebody else other than me. It was the first time I said, you know what? Because when we moved here with Lowe's, I had to take a lesser role to get here. And I was like, you know what? It'll work itself out. It always does. So I took a back seat. We came here so my wife could be closer to her career. I could be closer to my mother and father and my brother. And lo and behold, 5 months later, I got promoted. A year and a half later, I got promoted again. And just when I was in line to get promoted again, they wanted me to take over operations in Tennessee. I was approached by the company I currently work for, and I've been with them for 3 years now. And believe it or not, how you see me today is how I go to work every day. I'm in the sports facility management business. I manage a sports facility for soccer and baseball, and I run all operations in the Southeast. I run 77 locations. It's a pretty cool-ass gig. and all I get to do is talk athletics and sports all day long, which is right up my alley. So I'm running tight on time. I apologize, you all. Please forgive me. Let me see where I am. What I've gained out of this, besides, man, I was able to turn things around, get things going. What I've gained is the steps give me a sense of peace. They give me a blueprint to follow. I'm a kind of structured guy from the standpoint of, believe it or not, as much as I broke rules, I like structure. I like rules. That's why I like athletics. They provide structure. So they give me a piece and a blueprint, and they've carved out a life for me like I couldn't imagine. What I've gained is I don't worry about anything anymore because I don't lie anymore. I don't have to worry about anything. I used to have to worry about, you know, what I said, the story I told. I don't have to worry about it anymore because I don't lie anymore. What I've gained, I'm accountable. Other people depend on me. I strive daily to be a better version of the guy I was the day before. People look up to me now. Believe it or not, in the industry that I'm in, I'm actually considered an expert. And I'm highly regarded, and people call me to ask me for advice about how to do things. That just blows me away. That I'm considered an expert in something and that I'm held in high regard. What's changed? Man, my wife loves me more than I thought anyone other than my parents could love me. I mean, she literally loved the hell out of me. She literally did. What has changed? My circle of friends is very, very tight. I only associate with a very, very small group of people. I had to distance myself from a lot of friends. I keep things really, really simple. I'm always where I say I'm going to be. I'm always doing what I said I was going to do. If you wanted to send a hitman out for me, I'm either at home, at work, at the gym, in a meeting, or I'm shopping. Because I love to shop. Yeah, I have a shoe collection out of this world. Yeah. The greatest thing, I admit when I'm wrong. And I never did that. I had this thing of where I used to say, I regret. I never would say, I'm sorry. I would say, I regret. Hey, man, I'm sorry I fucked you over and I regret that you feel bad about it. That was the way I explained things. Hey, man, I regret, you know, I screwed you over. I regret, you know, I didn't show up when I told you, you know. Hey, if you feel a certain way about it, that's on you. But now I can truly say I'm sorry. What can I do to make it right? I do 5 things consistently on a daily basis. Every morning I pray. Hard to walk out of the door angry, upset, and mad after you've prayed. Every day I read some kind of literature. Every day I hit meetings on a regular basis. I can't say I go to meetings every day, but I found the right mix that works for me. I call another alcoholic on a regular, ongoing basis, and at the end of every night I pray. It's hard to go to sleep angry, mad, and upset after you've prayed for what you're grateful for. And that's just my consistent flow on a regular basis. I'm a kinder, more considerate guy. I understand what humility is. I realize that a God of my understanding is amazing. I finally understand that God loves me. If God had a refrigerator, my picture is on it. I mean, he's got a magnet picture of Keith. Man, God loves me. He absolutely adores me. Lastly, what I love about What I love about AA reminds me the most of athletics. All right. In athletics, you have a coach. My coach is my spiritual mentor, my sponsor. I have a coach who helps me navigate life. I have a quarterback, you know, in this meeting. You have somebody who leads the meeting. They're the quarterback of the meeting. I have blockers and defenders. Those blockers and defenders are people who are in my network. They keep shit off of me. They help walk me through when I have problems or when I have issues. I have cheerleaders. What do cheerleaders do? Whether you fall down, whether you score the winning touchdown, whether you drop the pass, or whether you kick the field goal, all they do is encourage you. I have cheerleaders in here who are good, bad, or indifferent. They just want me to succeed. And then I have fans. And fans, I kind of classify as, you may not know me that well. You know of me, but you know what I've been through because you've been through the same thing. And all you'd want is for me to win. And that's all fans want for their team to do, is to win. So AA reminds me the most of sports and athletics. And I think that's why it works so well. for me. The last thing I'll do is tell you a story, and then I'm telling the story for a purpose, and then I'll stop. Again, I appreciate you guys' patience. I apologize. I've run long. There's this really prim and proper Southern Baptist church. And at this church, I mean, they come in suit and tie. They're carrying Bibles. The women have on dresses. They have on bonnets. I mean, they do it like the right way. So this minister of this prim and proper Southern Baptist church is giving this just fire and brimstone, hell and fury sermon, and all of a sudden, boom, man, the doors kick open, and this hippie walks in. And he's got on these dirty shorts, he's got on sandals, he's got on a tank top, hair all over the place, he's dirty. He walks right down the center aisle. People are clutching their pearls, having heart attacks, all of the above. And he goes and he plops down on the front pew and sits and listens to the sermon. Now, it kind of throws the minister off, but he powers through the rest of his sermon. At the end of it, everybody is shaking the minister's hand as they're leaving, and the minister gets to this hippie, and he says, "Son, what are you doing?" He said, "This is a prim and proper Southern Baptist church. This is not the way that we do things. What I need you to do is to go home and ask God how you're supposed to conduct yourself in my church, and I hope to see you next Sunday." Next Sunday rolls around, minister is killing it again. Oh, man, he's bringing thunder. Right in the middle of his service, boom, doors kick open. This time, the hippie has on tattered shorts, no shoes, no shirt. He walks down the front aisle, clutching pearls, people having heart attacks, all kinds of shit. He goes to the front. He doesn't sit on the front pew. This time, he plops down in front of the pulpit in yoga style and sits and listens to the sermon. Minister can't take it anymore. He stops in mid-service. He says, "Son, what are you doing? I thought I told you to go ask God how you're supposed to conduct yourself in my church." And the hippie stands up. He says, "Sir, I did ask God. God said he's never been to your church." Now, I tell that story because here in these rooms, I see miracles every day. I have felt the presence of God more in here than I think I can say I felt in any church. I mean, I see miracles daily. I see evidence of God's love, and I see his works in like real time. And it is amazing that I get to be a part of a program that not only saved my life, but it exposed me to the love that God has to offer me. And it allowed me to reestablish a relationship with my higher power that is like nothing I've ever known. So, I'll end with that. My name's Keith. I'm an alcoholic, and thanks for letting me share.